Yeah. What up, what up? 215. WHYY. Show your brother your love, let's go. Back. Master, Spider, Storm, Super on deck, Triple Nation is born. We get it on from coast to coast. All around the globe, folks take the oath. I'm a triple furry, I'm a triple true. From the way I roll to the way I coo. Too cool to be nerds, too cute to be geeks. The community tunes in whenever we speak. IGFB podcast retweet. Get the newest and the coolest going on each week. So come on in, here's your invitation. Stand up and be counted in the Triple Nation. Yeah.
Hey, what's up everybody? How you doing? This is Len, aka the Bat Triple. Welcome to the April edition of Triple Nation here on WHYY and newsworks.org. For April, you know what we do every year with the Black Tribbles? It's Octavia City, a celebration of Afrofuturism, as well as the legacy and legend of noted sci-fi author Octavia E. Butler. This evening on Tribble Nation, I am joined by a cavalcade, I think that's how you say it. I probably said it all jacked up. But whatever, I try to sound smart on WHYY and I fail horribly. I'm joined by a cavalcade, a whole bunch of people. And joining me as co-host to my left, I have the new girl. It's that girl. It's Charlie Brownskin. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, I can't. She actually appeared on the Michelle Mission. And now she's here on her first official Black Tribble show, which means that tonight will be the night that you join the Tribble Nation.
I told you I've been waiting for this moment.
We've been waiting for so long.
Oh, yes. The anticipation mounting.
And it was very timely, of course, for me to have met you because we've actually only met over the last couple of months. But within that time, I have learned how much of a devotee you are of everything Octavia Butler.
Yes, she is. Easily my favorite author. Anything written by Octavia is my favorite.
That is cool. We're going to get into that later
on. I'm excited to share.
Also joining me tonight is, speaking of the Michelle Mission, ladies and gentlemen, helping me co-host this evening is my co-host on the Michelle Mission, which is Two Men, One Podcast, Every Black Film Ever.
Everyone.
It is Drexel University's very own Vincent Williams.
Hey, hey, how y'all doing? Vincent Williams here, Drexel University, the Michelle Mission, and it's All Soul Wednesdays 8 to 10.
On G-Town Radio.
On G-Town. I didn't know if we could say G-Town Radio.
You can say G-Town
Radio.
You
saw, right? I'm just trying to play my position.
I understand.
But I'm happy to be here to talk about Octavia Butler as well.
I know, because you actually have an interesting story to tell.
I have an interesting story. I wrote my dissertation on Octavia Butler. So
I know. So that's cool.
The whole John is on Octavia Butler.
The whole John?
I'm a doctor of Octavia Butler.
And you wear it well, my friend.
Well, you know.
You wear it well. We are also going to be joined by M. Aisley Ducan, a noted filmmaker here in the city of brotherly love, who's hard working on a documentary on speculative fiction called Invisible Universe. We're going to talk to her about that as well. But she also had a meeting, very special meeting, with Octavia Butler. So we're going to try tonight, as part of Octavia City, to try and bring you a little bit closer to Octavia Butler. You know, you can read her books, all of her books and the interviews with her. But when you talk to people that have had firsthand accounts with her, you actually probably, I think, paint a more fuller picture of who the woman is.
Right.
But first, we are going to kick things off with talking to a fan of Octavia Butler and an author in his own right and a colleague of Vincent's at Drexel University.
A gentleman and a scholar.
He's a scholar. I don't know about a gentleman.
Reserve judgment till the end of the show.
Yeah, we reserve judgment on that one. It is Andre Carrington in here with his new book, Speculative Blackness, The Future of Race in Science Fiction. Andre, how are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm getting over a cold, so I can't say I'm well. I need to get well, but I'm all right.
You're all right. Well, yeah. You're all right enough for here, and yes. You're far enough away from me. So,
right.
So it works, brother. It does work.
I am not contagious over the radio.
No.
Hopefully you're not contagious in the room.
No. Okay. That's, you know how it goes. You're contagious while it incubates, and then once you're symptomatic, you're usually not contagious anymore.
See how smart he is?
See?
I know.
Right? See?
I know. We have just raised the IQ level of Triple Nation.
I don't believe in that. I
don't. Trust me. You haven't been around us.
IQ tests are discriminatory.
That's so true.
True.
We don't believe in that.
That's very true. That is very true. Well, haven't I been spanked? All right. So all that and more is coming your way on the April edition, the Octavia City edition of Triple Nation. Stay tuned. Speculative Blackness, The Future of Race in Science Fiction, Andre Carrington's new release that talks about race in science fiction, but you use, Andre, from what I'm looking at in the book, you use a lot of the more popular forms of the genre to get into that conversation, which I think is kind of interesting and smart, actually, because you have an entire chapter dedicated to Star Trek and Lieutenant Uhura, an entire, like, whole almost dissertation on Storm.
Yes.
Of the X, right, of, right, the, right. Of the X-Men. Yeah. And then you actually get into where I wanted to start a little bit, on your thoughts on Benjamin Sisko in Star Trek and Deep Space Nine, whose portrait in Star Trek I've always enjoyed and found probably more nuanced than almost any other character in Star Trek lore, because that, you know, he's a single black man raising his son in space. He seems to be a lot more maybe as learned as Captain Picard.
Yeah.
You know, but as down with it as Kirk is.
Yeah.
Maybe as thoughtful. He's like the amalgamation of all the popular captains to me. You know what I mean?
He's a culmination of the two who came before, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of Kirk and Picard.
Yeah.
You know? Yet you had an interesting read on Sisko, I thought, reading in your book.
Yeah, I started out by saying, to characterize him, right, that we had Kirk, who was the adventurer, hero, Casanova, in a way that he could be the lead in a lot of science fiction stories.
Right.
He gets the girl, or he gets the alien girl, or he doesn't conquer the planet, right, because he's more enlightened in his mindset. Right, right. So he's not there to conquer, right? He's there as a humanity, all of our best values. And then Picard is more nuanced, right, is very much a figure of, you know, the 80s and 90s, who kind of speaks to a kinder, gentler Starfleet, right? A little more of that, like, scientific inquiry and cosmopolitanism and diplomacy, which is very sophisticated, right? But Sisko, in part because he has a backstory that's simultaneous with Star Trek The Next Generation, is he has to be something other than the main face and main voice of what Star Trek is for people watching TV at that time. And I think that the way they stage that is to introduce him as somebody who grows into, over time, a role that really assures you that Starfleet is a military organization, and he's a soldier.
Right.
And when he starts out the series, he's a commander and not a captain, and so he's still taking his orders from higher-ups.
Mm-hmm.
So even if he doesn't like everything that's his mission, he has to execute it. And over time, you see in that series an actual war takes place, and he has to act as a military leader in a way that, you know, the protagonists of these other stories did sometimes and didn't sometimes.
Right.
And so I think that makes his whole role very different.
Yeah, yeah. And then especially when you factor in the whole aspect of him being the now I'm drawing a blank on what he was. Not the Oracle.
The emissary.
The emissary for the Bajorans.
Yeah.
And them seeing him almost as this, like, prophet or religious figure.
Right.
In their history. And him grappling with that. Him grappling was trying to understand, like, whoa. I'm just me. You know, but the signs are all there.
Yeah, he struggles with that, which is something you don't see in the other Star Trek narratives, right? Mm-hmm. He struggles with religion through that role, and religion is kind of a thing of the past as far as Star Trek is concerned. You know, it's mm-hmm. you know, human beings are past all that. Most other species are supposedly, they have maybe a belief system, but they sort of live their belief system through their laws and through their technology and their culture, and you don't necessarily call it religion. But for Sisko, right, he has an epiphany, he has this awakening to this higher power that he believes in, and it's known throughout the whole series that this is meant to be a presence in the story that you can treat as aliens, the
right.
way that you would another story. But for him as a very grounded character, it looks a lot like somebody dealing with, you know, sort of coming to religion late in life after mm-hmm. being, you know, a scientific thinker, a military thinker, somebody who's concerned with the law and his own culture as a human being. And that's a very different kind of thing to see in a science fiction story.
Yeah, it is.
I also like Sisko as sort of the gray morality that you have and you know, as far as you know, like you said, it's concurrent with Next Generation,
right?
So you know, you do have that sort of that sort of command by committee,
right,
that Picard used to do. And I thought that was a good observation, that it is more of a military tale. I always say, you know, you could kind of track Sisko's development as his look changes.
Yes.
You know, he like shaves his head and becomes Hawk
right.
in space.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That like his kid grows up and so he's a little, I mean, he's very fatherly and very affectionate, but you know, that softness that he has as a parent of a young son is not the same later on.
Yeah.
And then once his kid has got kind of a mother figure, once he's got a love interest, he's hardened by his experiences. And so Avery Brooks, who is just a beast as an actor, he embodies that role in a way that shows you, you know, here is what kind of story it is. Here is what kind of hero you have in this version of this narrative.
Right. Now, did you grow up with Star Trek and enjoying Star Trek?
Yeah, very much so. I didn't watch the original series on TV much because The Next Generation was on when I was a kid.
Right.
And so it was exciting. Mm-hmm. It was new. My whole family would watch it. But as an adult, I came to want to know about the original series.
Okay.
And when I watched it, I saw, oh, this is so much cooler. There's so much more to this
mm-hmm.
if you realize that it has this like 40, 50-year history at this point. And
right.
it makes it much more exciting to realize that there's more to tap into.
Yeah.
So I grew up with Star Trek on TV and science fiction films usually. On TV, I got to see Terminator 2 when I was too young to see that. But it's
don't we all?
It's an excellent film. It is just an excellent work of art.
We all get those movies like too early.
Right, you know? Right.
I snuck my daughter at 4 years old to see Blade 2. That was a bad move.
You know, but
that took me to see Die Hard.
But Blade is a very important film. And there are not many. I mean, Blade 2, I don't know about all that. But, you know, for completion, I can understand that you needed her to know what happened.
Right. There's so many unanswered questions.
Right.
At the end of the first one.
Right.
I couldn't get a babysitter. I took my daughter. A part of your book, part of the reason for your writing your book is, and the reason why you use the avenues to get into your conversation that you do of, you know, your horror storm and Star Trek is about taking what has happened before and then looking at them again.
Yeah.
Through fresher and more enlightened eyes.
Yeah.
You know, when did the whole idea of this spark in your head for your book?
This, it started as my dissertation, and I wanted to examine comics. I wanted to examine superhero comics as science fiction texts, and I wanted to examine science fiction fan culture.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading scholarship on it that was fairly new at the time and thought, this is actually really exciting because I am a fan, right? I'm in fan communities online and talking to people about these issues, but academically, this is a conversation that hasn't been had yet.
Yeah.
So it germinated for me in grad school that way, but the distance that those ideas traveled between then and 4 or 5 years ago, when it really coalesced as a book with a real solid itinerary, that came from kind of understanding that, looking back at the popular culture mm-hmm. over decades and looking at different moments that could sort of be treated one by one and mm-hmm. be treated as sort of certain patterns repeating and certain black authors and performers taking up questions that have been laid out for them by previous installments in the genre. That approach came together once I was much smarter, which was years after grad school.
Oh, you were smart all the time. I could tell.
Yeah, but not like smart, but not like good at things. Right? There's a difference.
Who introduced you? Who or what was it that introduced you to science fiction?
Just life, just the world, right? I mean, I want to say like UPN, right? Just the fact.
Really?
That,
right.
No, I mean the fact that Star Trek was syndicated, mm-hmm. That The Next Generation was on like regular TV that you could access without cable.
Right.
And comic books were a dollar, some of them like 75 or like 90 cents or like a dollar or a dollar 10 cents when I was in high school. That was, you know, low cost, kind of edifying entertainment. And being bookish and nerdy and connecting and disconnecting with nerdy friends, that was an in for me. And so I realized over time, like, oh, I like this thing. I like this set of things. I have this knowledge. These are the kind of friends I'm going to have. These are the kinds of stories I'm going to want to continue reading.
Right.
And so having built that up as a young person, it just stayed with me.
So I was going through the book a little bit. Let me ask you, who is Carl Joshua Brandon?
Ooh, that is the $25 question, which is to say,
well, I've got $20. You got $5.
That's cool.
Charlie?
No, I can do that. I could. That's actually legit. That's, you know, I can give you a little discount. So there is right now an organization called the Carl Brandon Society.
Yes,
you might have heard of them. You might know some of their prominent members, like Nalo Hopkinson.
Mm-hmm,
You might. They have an email list on which a lot of really great conversation happens about SF writers of color.
Yeah, a
sharing
lot of speculative
tips
fiction.
And yeah, just talking about their successes and outlets for participating in conventions and publishing work. They are named after a figure who is sort of like a figure who came at another point in the history of science fiction fan culture. Carl Brandon was a black fan writer from the Bay Area who participated in the National Organization for Science Fiction Fans, mm-hmm. That was a circuit of 50 to 100 people who would write and publish fanzines independently. And this was like in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
So they would type these on typewriters and mimeograph them mm-hmm. and send them to each other across the country and sometimes outside the U.S. Those fans had, you know, in order to keep a circuit of communication together at that time, they had to have each other's addresses and all that. They had to sort of know who each other were, but never had to meet in person.
Yeah.
So in order to correspond and send their, like, you know, 2 or 3 page fanzine or their, like, 20 page fanzine to a bunch of other people who would then get their other fanzines, you know, they knew each other by name. They were on a list of who was a member and who was on the waiting list and so forth. And at one point, a group of white fans in the Bay Area decided that they would sort of test out the racial attitudes of their peers who, as far as they knew, were all white, some men, some women. Turned out, as is often the case, some people who were just writing under pen names were women who used men's names.
Yes.
Some people were married couples who used one name and one address and paid for one membership. Right. Right. And in the course of that communication, they decided to having invented another writer who was not a real person, but who was a synthesis, who was a name for an author, Carl right. Brandon, that they had come up with. People knew that there was Carl Brandon, right? They thought, oh, well, there are these four guys in the Bay Area. There's this guy, and Carl, and that other guy. And Carl was not a real guy. But people knew that Carl was one of the writers of some of these fanzines. So in order to kind of test out the racial attitudes of their peers at a time when they were talking about these issues amongst themselves, they decided, hey, Carl is a person we made up. Let's say that Carl's black. Now, let's have Carl say that Carl is black and has been black this whole time so that people realize, oh, all the things we've been saying in front of, you know, by way of letters and fanzines to each other.
Right. Right.
We've been saying this in front of a black person. Oh, okay. So, like, now everybody has a black friend in this little community
wow.
of science yeah. fiction fans in the 50s.
So that's the black friend.
It is. He is the black friend. Sometimes I hear people say, like, oh, well, I have a very good friend who's black. And I'm like, is he Carl Brandon?
Right, right.
Like, who is he, though?
You know Carl!
Where does he live, though?
Right.
Right? Like, where does he live? Does his grandma live in Sacramento? Yeah, but that's made up, too. Right, but having already used pseudonyms and pen names and duplicates of themselves and different personas, it made perfect sense to do that. But it was another ripple in that community to say, oh, well, you know, one of us, who as far as you know is real, he's also black, right? He's just like you. He's just like us. But he's black. And so having that persona around for a couple years, who was a hoax, it seemed to this community of fans in the 1950s that they all sort of shared the same thoughts about science fiction, about popular culture, about the business of being in sort of amateur publishing, of
right.
making your own documents and mm-hmm. circulating them. They were all like very high-minded and very celebratory. And when occasionally they would fight about things, like McCarthyism was really a hot issue at the time, and there were different attitudes about it mm-hmm. across the country, they could kind of have enlightened debates about this stuff and still consider themselves friends and believe that one of the participants in that whole conversation was black. And so in a way, they developed this attitude that like, oh, black people are just like us. Like, we're just like that. But I'm like, no, black people are just like you.
Right,
like,
right.
He's
right.
not a real guy.
Right.
And so as I discuss in the book, the perpetrators of the hoax revealed it at one point because there was a sort of a critical situation, a situation that they had to confront about whether this person who was not a real person was going to take on a leadership role in their fan organization. That would have made the whole hoax thing a lot harder
right,
to deal
right,
with.
Right, right.
But at the time, in reading about this incident in the past, in fanzines from the 1950s, in reading them, I got the sense that, oh, I can see how they would believe he was real, and I can see how they would believe he was black, because I'm, you know, for me, reading like dozens and dozens of, you know, fanzines from 50 different people in, say, like 1952. All of them are just recounting their lives and what they think of each other and what they think about what somebody said a year ago in another fanzine. And all they are is just words on a page.
Yeah.
Right. Right? If you've got a mimeograph, which is pretty cheap, or if you've got a slightly cheaper kind of reproductive text machine, like a hectograph or that was a real throwback, like a Ditto, which is a different thing, a spirit duplicator, like all this stuff. If you had that, then essentially you had a platform,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It was a little bit like having a blog, but it was so hands-on that there would be no reason you believe that it wasn't a real person, right? Putting that stencil into a typewriter, typing those words,
yeah.
you know, putting them in the mail. Like, that's a real physical thing to do, right?
Wow.
So of course you would believe he was real. And to me, like reading the works of all these people, I thought, oh, well, these people are very real to me as mm-hmm. like historical right, figures in right. an archive. They're real to me the way that any author is real to me. I don't really know them in real life,
right.
but they're real to me through their words. And so it was like a really interesting insight into the minds of, right, who did this community of readers think black people were?
And, yeah.
And who did they think they were in relation to them when they thought that was a part of their community?
Yeah, that's I wonder about that too. Like you said, yeah, you could fool yourself into thinking, well, you are fooling yourself into thinking, you know what I mean? That, you know, we all share the same experience. We all coming from looking at everything from the same outlook.
Right.
You know, all because it's you are looking from the same outlook. It's not really a black person looking at that and seeing it for what it is, you know, and I thought that was real curious reading that story.
Yeah, at the time, right? So people are in fanzines, they're reacting to the same kinds of things we are, right? Like it gets announced that somebody is going to play a character in a movie based on a comic that people have read.
Yeah,
and people are reacting to that. And for them, it takes like a month or two, right?
For it to get back
to put it all together,
right?
But for us, you know, it takes a day, a news cycle. But for them, right? If they're hearing, Ray Bradbury is going to write the script for a movie adaptation of Moby Dick, right? Like that was a big hot button issue at the time, and they roasted him. And these are people who love Ray Bradbury. He's alive and well. He's in there, right? He's a part of their ongoing culture. His works are still new to them.
Yeah.
But like they roasted him. They were like parodies for days of like, then the hulking white whale came over the horizon with an atomic. They were loving and ribbing all of the things that made science fiction what it was at the time. But of course, they could think that like, oh, well, somebody who's doing this with us, even if they view things slightly differently, right? Like, oh, well, this is a black person and he would like to be called Negro.
Yes.
He's not a real black person, but a black person in 1954 would want to be called Negro. Like, that makes perfect sense. So they're going about their day. A black person in 1954 doesn't want to be called a racial slur. They will believe that, too. That makes perfect sense. If it were a real black person, they might have said the same thing.
Mm.
But in that shared conversation about like, oh, Ray Bradbury is doing this and like, oh, well, you know, Harlan Ellison has always actually cared about this stuff. So what does he think? Like the conversation was very much sort of like a controlled experiment, right? Like this is the placebo group. Like you think you have a black person.
Right.
We've secretly replaced them with Folger's crystals. Right. But that's basically what it was. And unintentionally, right, they teach us all of these things now in the present, but at the time they were sort of going through this growing pain situation that they grew out of, right? Mm-hmm. Once they realized it was a hoax, they kind of grew out of it. But it's really instructive to say, right? Like, what do people say when they think no one's listening?
Yeah.
But also like, what do you already know people say when nobody's listening? Right.
Right.
You kind of already know what people are saying about you by the way they act in front of you. And that's just as evident. It's not shocking. It's not sensational. But it kind of reinforces what we already know, right? That this is an area of popular culture to come together around, and we might share a lot of the same thoughts. But how we conduct ourselves and relate to each other publicly, you know, you have to really be there, right? Actual black people have to actually be there participating to let us know what it really is like.
Right.
Your book, you also talk about the whiteness of science fiction, which is, on its surface, at least to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure you will because, you're a teacher. On its surface, to me, speaking about when there are heroic figures or in science fiction that a lot of times, without there being any type of illustrative or descriptive text about them, it's almost already assumed that they are white or humanoid, but certainly not of any kind of color or ethnicity.
Yeah.
But I think I think the whiteness of science fiction, as you talk about it in your book, it maybe is even on a deeper level than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we probably, right, we all probably share that that recognition, right? That assuming that whiteness is allowed to be unmarked, right? Mm-hmm, that if you don't specify that somebody's racial identity is other than white, typically, then that allows you to assume they're white, right? Or it's a big reveal when you find out they're not, like a Carl Brandon. Right. And that's very much a part of it when it comes to who authors are and who their heroes are and what readers imagine they are experiencing when they relate to text. Sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean that. Sometimes it means that if there is no information there about racial identity, then people come to the text and read them and think, oh, well, that person could look like me, or that author, I don't know who they are, they could look like me. And right. that's very generative. But 9 times out of 10, it's, you know, it's the other way. What I think is deeper and more significant, and the reason that I, you know, make a phrase like the whiteness of science fiction something I'm willing to argue for, is that it's actually a way of getting at how science fiction, like everything else in popular culture, in, you know, the business of writing and the business of making films and media industries and education, like everything in culture, has a history that's the same history that we have all experienced, in which white supremacy has been a very powerful, dominant, influential force, right. And that it's not separate from that. So science fiction is a good place to look for things that make whiteness mean all of the things it does, and we'd be kidding ourselves if we thought otherwise. That's what I mean by the phrase. So that we can look at, for instance, we can look at the like scientific romances in the 19th century and see that they are, you know, sometimes very thinly veiled allegories about imperialism and colonialism mm-hmm. and right. Orientalism. Like we already know that, but I don't think that we know that, but we don't like feel it. You know, we don't like take it as seriously as we could.
Right.
And I think that there's more work to be done.
Why don't you think we do that? Why do you?
I wish we did, but I think we don't, in part because we trick ourselves into saying like, oh, but this is just fantasy, right? Oh, this is just imaginary, right? It's a metaphor. We don't have to take it seriously, right? I think that narrative that science fiction and fantasy are trivial allows us to take for granted the sort of deep cultural work they do. But then I think we also don't take seriously, right, like the role of normative assumptions about race and power in popular culture. I think we don't take them seriously as influences on who we are, in part because we treat the imagination and our dreams and fantasies as if they're separate from the rest of our lives, right? As if they're separate from work, as if they're separate from our interpersonal relationships, as if they're diversions, or as if they're, you know, if they're jobs, like an actor does a job or a writer does a job, then they're just a job. But actually, you know, the work we do makes us who we are.
Yeah.
Right? And what we dream very much shapes, it's because of who we are when we're awake, and it shapes who we are in our waking hours. So that stuff is actually with us all the time. And I think those habits of thinking encourage us to think, oh, well, if this is a fantasy of exploring the galaxy and colonizing other planets, then, well, you know, it's just a fantasy. But I'm like, hold on, like, of all the things you bring to other planets, colonialism? Like, wait a minute. Like, right. Hang on. Like, yeah. Wait, no, that's not the best thing. All the things, right? Like, even that, you know, that's like simplistic and superficial, but it kind of gets at how, oh, actually, you know, ingrained in how we dream and think and imagine, and how we encode that in culture when we say, oh, well, this is fantasy, this is imagination, this is diversion, this is science fiction. Ingrained in that is a certain habit to treat fantasizing and imagination in a certain way, and to not recognize that those are really actually, those are productive activities. Those are things we learn how to do,
right,
and things that we teach each other how to do. And if we learn them the same way, and if we teach them the same way, then we don't use them constructively to do other work, right? To do other play, to do other kinds of dreaming, to realize other kinds of goals, right? So I think that those things are important, and it's meaningful when the fantastic and the imaginative narratives we get reproduce a kind of world and a kind of order of things that resembles the one we live in now, which has a lot of problems.
Yeah, I found that a lot of people that follow the writings of Octavia Butler, at least a lot of fans that I've spoken to, that's what they get from her readings.
Yeah.
And that as fantastical as some of the worlds are that she and pictures that she shapes in her writings, they still take something from there that helps, that defines them and defines how they go about their life, how they look at life. And I think that's the magic of fiction.
Yes.
Of science or otherwise, you know. I love myself some Batman.
Yeah.
I'm not beating up on the Joker.
No.
But I do try and live by an ordered life like Bruce Wayne, you know. So I think that's the role of fiction to some degree. Wouldn't you say?
I would. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a kind of exercise for the imagination.
Right.
But it's also a kind of, it's training for it, but then it's also what your imagination is training for.
Yeah.
Right? That's actually the game.
I have a question around that. What do you think, that in participating in the consumption of fiction, science fiction, helps us to do that? Or do you think it can train us? Or, you know, I'm interested in, you know, youth development as well. So from whatever age, do you think that science fiction can train us to decompartmentalize life? Or do you think that because it takes us into this other world, this so-called other world, that somehow we don't actually get to deal with the life that's there when we come away from the dream?
You know, I think that it does offer us opportunities to kind of break down those boundaries between what we think is impossible and unattainable and what we think we can do, how we want to invest our energies, right? I think that the typical way that story is told, right, is like, oh, well, science fiction can become science fact, right? And like early 20th century science fiction, a lot of it was about that. About a sort of constructive way to imagine scientific possibilities and sort of extend what people were doing in the industrial age and say like, okay, well, if radio waves can do this, maybe they can do that, right? If you can recognize like the possibility of air travel in the beginning of the 20th century, then you can think of different kinds of air travel that might be possible someday. That's a kind of science fiction that I think is actually that there could be more of, that more people could be engaged in, that I think is actually a useful counterpart to the more sort of like technical, constrained, kind of practical and career-oriented education in science that people get today, right? Mm-hmm. Because we are very frequently encouraging people to invest themselves in learning practical skills, right? Learn to code, become an engineer,
right?
Understand biological science in order to go into medicine. But, I mean, particularly now, there are so many imaginative, hypothetical, speculative, right, applications of that kind of knowledge that we could extend in any number of directions that we just aren't doing now as a society. And I think part of it is because, you know, that because so much is possible through like the real science and maybe the real sort of technical, practical uses of scientific knowledge, because we can do so much practically, maybe a little bit of that hypothetical, speculative stuff is no longer, you know, it's no longer in vogue, it's no longer valuable, it's no longer a looks like a good investment. And I think that actually that's necessary, right? Because you need imaginative, creative thinking to do, you know, truly radical work, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, right, I mean, to me, that should be the goal. Like, if I understood, right, biological sciences half as well as many people who learn biology in order to be doctors, maybe because of reading certain kinds of narratives, I would think about what to do with that knowledge differently, right? Or I'd suspend some of the assumptions that people make when they think, you know, you acquire this knowledge in order to use it the same way it's always been used. So I think that that's, you know, I think it's necessary to supplement sort of your practical knowledge with, you know, speculation, with experimentation, like in that purely, you know, mental, fantastical, imaginative sense. And I think it can go along with, right, staying invested in doing the practical work you need to do to, right, like, fight Ebola, fight the Zika virus, right? Like, right. Treat and ensure healthy lives and possibilities for people with HIV. Like, you need to do those things. But the point of doing that is so that people can flourish, right? So that they can extend their possibilities, not so they can keep doing things the same way.
Can I read this little quote? I found this in a bookstore called BMV when I was in Toronto a few months ago. And the book is called Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow. And it's a graphic novel by Brian Fees. And there's a quote on the inner cover says, "Whatever happened to the world of tomorrow, people believed in it for a long time. Then they gave up on it for a long time. And then gradually, without even necessarily meaning to, they built it." And that's like, I love that you're talking about what's necessary to innovate. We're talking about like innovation, right? And what I find in working with young people and adults and seeing like where creativity is, how creativity is developed or what feeds creativity, is that there is a sense of there is a need for structural innovation and the technology to support human creativity. And we need like this new level of like ease of life in order for us to get to the like creative space. But if we're still compartmentalizing and kind of going around and around with issues like race, do you, how long do you think it'll take for us to cycle this before we get to like more ease so we can be more creative?
I mean, I always have a boring answer when people ask me things like, oh, well, why is it, why is there not as much diversity in, you know, in the fantastic genres? Or like, why isn't there as much diversity in like, you know, the mainstream media and stuff? And I'm like, because people's life chances are constrained by systematic oppression. Like, because it's hard to do anything, right? When it's hard to do everything.
Right.
I'm like, that's basically it, right? Yeah. But that idea that, that, you know, our creative energies and our imaginative faculties will be freed up by that technical innovation, it's, there's also a boring answer to that, right? There's a boring Marxist narrative that that's sort of how things would go, that Marx and Engels in their lifetime thought like, oh, cool, see, check it out. Once we get communism and people don't have to work, part of their idea was that you would reach that state of production when you could automate lots of things. And they were just thinking based on like basic industrialization and like fossil fuels and all that stuff that we didn't know meant what they did to the planet now. But they kind of thought that things would move in that direction and that automation would mean all of these good things and human beings would be free from labor. And so it would be more like realizing human potential without having to work to produce surplus value would mean that people could be more creative. They could have more leisure time, right? The 8-hour workday was like an idea that, oh, if you're not working all the time, you can do a lot more, right? It was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what you will. And then if those 8 hours for work got shorter and shorter, well, then you would just what you will all the time.
Right.
And that would be a beautiful state to live in. But getting there is not as simple as people predicted in the 19th century.
Very true. Speculative Blackness, the Future of Race in Science Fiction. It is in bookstores now. Ladies and gentlemen, it is out there. Doctor, I can call you doctor, can I?
You can call me Andre. I mean,
you can call me Ray.
I tell my students that my name is Professor Carrington. I tell my, my students, oh, my name is Andre, but all my friends call me Professor. So I tell them that.
Okay.
but no.
Andre Carrington, Speculative Blackness, the Future of Race in Science Fiction. Thank you so very much for stopping by the Tribble Nation. You can stay right there.
I will.
And you all stay right there. We're going to come back with Moments with Octavia right here on Tribble Nation. Stay tuned. April is Octavia City on all of the shows of Black Tribbles, and that includes Tribble Nation. And tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special treat for you as we are going to try and get in touch with Octavia Butler herself. By way of our guest this evening, we have, as previously mentioned, we have Vincent Williams of It's All Soul on G-Town Radio, as well as the podcast The Michaud Mission. And new right now into the studio, we have M. Osley Dukan, noted filmmaker whose documentary Invisible Universe looks at speculative fiction. And you can find out more information about it at InvisibleUniverseDoc.com. Welcome, Osley, to the Tribble Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, that's so nice. We love Invisible Universe, but we're here to talk to you today about your moments with the noted Afrofuturist and author Octavia Butler.
Hi, Osley. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Everyone's going to ask you. So Octavia City is the month of April. We are interested in the ways that the folks that are making this new wave of work, the next generation of speculative fiction, science fiction authors, filmmakers, musicians, are impacted, have been impacted by our forerunners. So please tell us a little bit about your interaction with Octavia Butler and how it's impacted your work.
Okay. Wow. So it's a really long story.
Okay. You've got 5 minutes.
Okay. Really quick. thank you for letting me know.
Yes.
So I grew up a fan of science fiction. I started off watching science fiction films and got into reading it later. One of the first writers I actually read was Octavia Butler. I was a teenager.
Really?
Late teenager, 17, 18, and I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and went to a black bookstore and was looking for something to read. And there's this book, like, on the shelf under sci-fi section, and I already was a fan, so I walked over to it, and it's like some white lady pulling, like, a sheet of, like, film off of this other potted white lady. And I was like, this looks interesting. So, and it turned out to be Dawn. From the Xenogenesis trilogy.
Right. Nice.
Yes.
So I picked it up and read it. And that's how it started for me, with my love of Octavia Butler and her work. And I should say a little bit, I always had a little difficulty with her work because I was like, I want these characters to be tougher. But as I got older and understood the ways of the world and different ways that people kind of navigate their experiences through the world, I really started to respect her the way she wrote her characters.
Okay.
So that is my origin story with Octavia Butler. Fast forward to 2003, and I just finished graduate school for film production. And
where did you go to school?
I went to the City College of New York.
Okay.
In Harlem. And I had heard about a conference at Howard University about black science fiction. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. I should go to this. And then I was like, wait, I'm a filmmaker. I should film this.
That's right.
So I reached out to the organizers and asked them if they were open to having me film it. And they were like, yes, because we're not doing that.
Oh, yeah, filming it. Yeah, that sounds good.
I went down there, and the main draw was a panel. It was an academic conference, but the main draw was a panel of five announced black science fiction writers. Unfortunately, one couldn't make it, and that was Samuel Delaney.
Oh.
But it was Samuel Delaney was announced, and Octavia Butler was there, and Stephen Barnes, Tanana Reeve-Do, and Nalo Hopkinson.
Nice.
So I went down, and while I'm filming I filmed the entire conference, but while I'm filming the panel, I started formulating this idea in my head, like, I think this is my next project, you know? So had never done a documentary before. I did little stuff in grad school, but I mainly consider myself a narrative filmmaker of speculative fiction, of films I like, horror and sci-fi, of course. So I decided that I wanted to make a project. I said I should probably make a project about black science fiction writers. And I went up to all the writers afterwards while they're signing books and in between that. And I was like, hi, my name's Osley. I'm making a documentary about you. You want to be in it? So, and that's how that started.
And you had the camera stuck in her face.
So I at least got contact information. Not everybody was like, jumping for joy at that moment. But got everybody's contact information. And then over the years, I kind of was on the lookout for different events and things going on. And I would go, you know, I'm living in Philly now, but I'm from New York. So I would go to events in New York when I could, or go out to wherever I can afford to go to, independent right. filmmaker, you know how that goes.
I know.
Eventually, what happened was, for the next 3 years, I basically followed Octavia Butler around.
Really?
In her public appearances. She came to New York several times. I filmed her in California. I filmed her in Seattle. And I got a good amount of footage of her during the last 3 years of her life. Mm. I would say over those years, you know, I'm making the film and I'm independent and, you know, I'm doing what I can and it's not done. And, you know, 3 years later, you know, it's not done. But they were very respectful of my efforts. But I would say the last time I saw Octavia was the real moment that I thought she really appreciated what I was trying to do with the project. She had she was receiving the Langston Hughes Award at City College in New York.
Okay.
And she kind of wandered in the back door and like nobody saw her. Like none of
How
the,
did nobody
the organ-
see Octavia about
She
you?
Just kind of, and you know, I was filming it, so I was waiting for her. So I saw her and I walked in with her and this is like an hour before the event, and we walked to the auditorium and we sat down and we just started talking, like she and I, you know, like I had seen her at events and filmed her and, you know, briefly talked to her, and she's, you know, busy doing her circuit. But this is like outside of doing an interview with her, which I was able to get early on. This was like a sit down moment with her after knowing her for a few years. And we sat there and we talked for a while.
What was your impression of Octavia Butler, having met her, of the woman herself? She's a tall woman, if I understand.
Well, she was a tall woman, yes.
Yes.
I was always nervous around her because I had lived with her work for so long. But, you know, she was a little tough and a little sharp, you know. But I think by the end of those 3 years when we were having this conversation, I felt like she really had opened up to me and understood what I was trying to do and was receptive. And we were talking about coming out to her. I was talking to her about coming out to her house. I was actually scheduled to come out to her house before she passed to interview her in her home. And, you know, she was warm. She was fair. She was funny. You know, she said she would always say she's not antisocial, but she's asocial. You know, mm-hmm. but she was always fair and she was funny and she could be, you know, a very warm person once you got to know her a bit, or she got to know you a bit.
Did you find that in her manner, in her conversation, that it reflected what we are seeing now in this collection of her writing and her journals that are coming out, in terms of her using a lot of the power of like thought and word and controlling her language around the abundance mindset and things like that? Did she speak in that manner?
My experience of Octavia, and also I've had the opportunity to get out to her archives and look at some of her work at the Huntington Library.
Huntington, right.
So adding that to my own, you know, short experience of knowing her, she would describe herself as a news junkie. So, I mean, I think from like a young age, she was starting to watch a lot of like news until she was into the Kennedy administration, or, you know, around the time when it was good. She was into the Apollo, you know, missions and such. So she would always describe herself as a news junkie. And I think she also did a lot of research for her books. You know, yes. She went to Peru to research for the Xenogenesis series. So I think she was well thought out in that way. Like, she was tapped into what was going on with the world. And I think she was very observant about, you know, her family. Her family migrated from New Orleans out to California. And in that whole experience, I really feel like it really shaped a lot of her writing, especially the parable books. Mm-hmm. Like, you can, if you, you know, some of the things that I've recorded her talking about, you know, she's talking about the experiences of her grandmother. And they're really reflected in those books. Like, you can,
really?
Basically, they are the foundation of those books.
Are you
so
talking
quite
about
this,
the references to L.A.? Or
I'm talking about the characters. Lauren Amina, specifically, you know.
Okay.
Her grandmother was quite an amazing woman. Mm. She, you know, had, I believe, 7 children. Sometimes it's hard to tell. You know, we're still going through the archives and conferring with people, but she came out to California by herself for work. They were her family came from a sharecropping family. Mm-hmm. And she basically worked her way up. She ended up being an entrepreneur. She opened two businesses. She had a tea house. She had a chicken farm. Mm-hmm. She became well respected in her neighborhood. And this is a woman who basically, you know, had children when she was really young and was a sharecropper and was from the South, the Deep South. And I think got married when she was really young to escape abuse from it within her family, you know. So it's, I think she was really tapped into those experiences of her family and putting it into her work. So, yeah.
Did you find that the time reflecting on her work and her family's story has influenced the way that you've committed yourself to doing your work and storytelling?
Of course. I mean, it's been a really long time for me to do this project, and I haven't, you know, I've been working independently on it and I haven't been able to kind of tap into a really big amount of money. I think I started too soon. Mm. I think I started a moment before people were really kind of recognizing what was going on. But Octavia's work inspires me to keep going and to tell her story and to tell everybody's story, really, because there's a lot of stuff going on now. And there are a lot of other stories to tell, and they're all kind of interconnected. Chip's interconnected with her, and she's interconnected with other writers who are, you know, out now. So, yeah, all of these people inspire me to keep working, and that, you know, I anticipate this year being the year. I have a wonderful editor right now who's doing amazing things with the work. We're actually re-editing the Octavia Butler section right now.
Nice.
And I'm supposed to be taking part in a conference. I don't know when this is going to air. But June 3rd to 5th out at...
Oh, this will be out before that. Yeah.
Okay. So UCSD out in California is having a Shaping Change conference dedicated to the work of Octavia Butler, and I'm going to be participating with that and probably showing some of this new cut segment that I'm putting together with my editor.
Nice.
Fantastic. Yeah. Have you gotten to give your characters some of that grit that you were looking for in her work?
Mm-hmm. I think, I think so. I think, part of it, a lot of the stories... And it could be influenced by Octavia. A lot of my stories, my science fiction stories, are women protagonists and people from lower economic backgrounds with amazing ability, you know, like stuff like that. So, yes, I think she's influenced, but I think we have, you know, we come from not a similar background, but we have connections to similar types of things in the world and ideas and experiences. And I think that definitely they're kind of interconnected. Mm.
Thank you.
Yeah. Vince,
yes,
you had your own connection.
I spent a day with Octavia Butler. Similarly, was introduced to her work. I read Parable of the Sower first, you know, maybe a year before I graduated from undergrad, and it completely blew my mind. And, you know, was a huge fan after that, and went to grad school here in Philadelphia at Temple, and my work centered on Octavia Butler. And I guess around 2004, 2005, this is right around that same period, she came to Temple to spend, you know, a couple of days with the Women's Studies Department. And long story short, you know, when these big time authors go to a school, they usually find a grad student to sort of, you know, be their assistant. And my chair pulled some strings and I got to hang out with her. By hang out with her, you know, just sort of make sure that everything was where it was supposed to be. And we talked, and I remember how generous she was with her time and just sort of how open she was with the ideas. It's funny, you were talking about the research that she did when she went to the Amazon, and you know, of course, she wrote the short story Bloodchild based on that. And Bloodchild is a story, she calls it a pregnant man story. And she also calls it her paying the rent story, because it's about a colony that goes to another planet. And there are intelligent beings there. And, you know, long story short, they're like insects and they plant eggs. But there's an afterword in the collection. And she says that, you know, people have said that it's about slavery and it's really a love story. So my interpretation was different. And I just remember how open she was to talking to me about the ideas in her story.
Wow.
And, and you know, we talked about Bloodchild and we talked about Parable of the Sower. And the other thing that I always remember is her optimism, you know, because if you read the stories, you know, even though oftentimes they're, you know, like Xenogenesis is actually after a nuclear exchange. And you know, even Parable of the Sower, people talk about it as, you know, almost a dystopia. But there's always this building of community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember her talking about, you know, if things are going to work out, we basically have to work together. Mm-hmm. And that has stayed with me since, both that generosity of spirit when it comes to ideas and that sort of optimism, that kind of seed of optimism and everything. So that's my 5-minute story. So, yeah.
So cute.
Oh, I love that you pointed to the colony building, the community building, the village building. You know, well, Black Tribbles knows that I run a bookstore in North Philly called Treehouse Books, and Octavia is our anchor author for this cycle. Mm-hmm. And the cycle theme is growth and potential. I taught Wild Seed to a group of teenage girls last summer, and we've used all of her books to inform a lot of the way that we're encouraging people to think about themselves differently and think about themselves as creator, and that their creation is intersecting with other people's creations, mm-hmm. and that their potential also relies on other people. And, you know, we're planting food in our backyard, and it's all like very genuinely informed by Mama Octavia's work,
right.
You know, like the way that she invited her readers to think about humanity's mistakes and what's possible for the next time we do this, because there can be a next time, you know, whereas there's often this sense of like complete destruction and like how will humanity survive? It's like, but you will.
Right.
Like, but we will. So what do you want to do? Like, there's always a choice. So I really appreciate you pointing to the community building. That's always an aspect of her work.
Yeah. Right. I wonder, do you think she had a sense or an appreciation for the impact that she was having in the genre, especially considering that as renowned as she was, you know, at the time, like you both have said, she's here in women conferences and she's going there, she's mm-hmm. going there, she's doing this, she's doing that. It still is in the genre of science fiction in general. She's still a relatively small name at most, you know, the world at large is considered. Yet she still has been just as impactful as the most prominent writers out there. Right. And I wonder if she, you know, if you have a feeling that she had an appreciation for that.
I got the feeling that things had started to change. And you know, I got the feeling that she kind of knew, and you know, certainly something like Kindred, mm-hmm. which, you know, was on every sort of book list. And you know, you think about, I know I was appreciative of the work that like magazines like Essence did.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
say that, you know, to go outside of what we
because they had just to piggyback on that, to explain it, that they actually ran pieces of Kindred.
Right. And they would, and so that you would talk to people who, you know, weren't necessarily quote unquote science fiction fans,
mm-hmm.
but they were Octavia Butler fans.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, I'm certainly you know this, you would go to Octavia Butler readings mm-hmm. and you would hear people say, you know, say that, like, I don't read science fiction, but I like Octavia Butler. And you know, certainly I've seen, you know, things in articles and scholarship where people talk about, you know, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Octavia Butler, and it's all in the same.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if you would say that there are science fiction conversations where her name isn't as prominent, her name is certainly prominent and had become prominent while she was alive in other places, which, you know, I can't speak for her, but I certainly appreciated it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
I think, I think she definitely was conscious of the fact that what she was doing was important. Just, you know, she mixed with different crowds. She was a loner per se, But there, you know, she went to the Essence writing retreat in the 80s. She, you know, she went to Clarence. So she was mixed into these different communities. She was friends with other Black writers. Mm-hmm. You can see it in her communications and in her archives. But I think just the fact that when she was 12 years old, she felt that she could write something better than Double Girl from Mars, which is, you know, one of her, the origin story of her writing.
Right.
That she knew that she had a voice from an early age. I think she knew that it was important to put her voice out there.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you both for sharing your moments with Octavia Butler and helping us try and bring her to life here within the studios of WHYY. It was very rewarding for me, who only recently has become really a fan of Octavia Butler, to be totally honest. And I still have holes in my Octavia Butler library that Kennedy still kicks my butt about. And I'm racing to get to, most certainly. But I really appreciate you coming in and sharing with us.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so now we've come to the moment of the show, ladies and gentlemen, where we have to do a little induction here. We've got all these guests that are eagerly waiting to get into the Tribble Nation. Now, Osley she's like a veteran of Black Tribbles, and she's already in the Tribble Nation. Let the people know exactly who you really are.
Ganja Tribble.
Yeah. Yeah, man. That's how she gets down. So she will help me as the only, you know, official Tribble, only other official Tribble here, since, you know, Andre Carrington is new, and Charlie Baltimore, a.k.a.
Charlie Brownskin.
And Charlie Brownskin, a.k.a. Charlyn Griffith of Treehouse Books, is new to the Tribble Nation. Mm-hmm. And Vincent Williams forgot his old Tribble designation.
Let's say renewing.
Yes, renewing.
Yeah,
renewing.
Membership? Yes, wow. Renewing membership.
Renewing.
Oh, spoken like a writer, Andre.
Thank you.
I'm just trying to help a colleague.
There you go.
Keeping up for your friend. I feel you, dog. So I want to induct you all. We'll start with you, Andre. What will be your Tribble designation that indicates where your geek lies?
Okay, so I studied this a little bit. I know
the man brought out the phone.
I know. I've got to capture this for posterity. So I know there is a Professor Tribble.
Yes, there is.
And I believe maybe there's a Dr. Tribble.
Yes, there is.
I heard Dr. Sheena Howard be inducted as Trouble Tribble.
Yes, she is.
Is there a speculative Tribble?
There is not a speculative Tribble.
There you go.
There is not. I could be that Tribble.
Yes, you can.
I can.
You can.
I will.
You will.
I will do this.
All right, sir. So speculative Tribble. I like that. Charlie Brownskin.
Mm-hmm.
Charlyn.
Yes.
What's going to be your Tribble designation?
I decided on this when I was on Michelle Mission. I think that my designation will be Lilith Tribble.
Lilith Tribble.
Yes.
I like that. Now, why Lilith Tribble?
I am paying homage to Mama Octavia because
there you go.
The Xenogenesis series is my favorite of nice. Her work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. I like that. Lilith Tribble.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Vincent.
Okay. See, here's a problem, Lynn. Like, I know you in so many different ways. Like I interact with Tribble World in so many different ways.
Yes,
is there a Jack Tribble?
Wow, there's not a Jack Tribble.
I will be Jack Tribble because I'm a jack of all trades.
Hey.
Yes.
There you go. I like that.
Jack Tribble.
I like that. Very Jack nice. Tribble. Okay, so we got Jack Tribble, speculative Tribble.
And you and I have a comic series that one day some... We'll get it out there. So there you go. Jack Tribble.
All right. Jack Tribble, speculative Tribble, Lilith Tribble. It's not official, though.
No.
Okay.
Not until this Tribble. says so. So I need you to raise your right hand to Stanley and your left to DC and repeat after me. And you make sure they get it right.
Wait a minute,
Ganja Tribble. You make sure they following through. All right.
Got it.
We'll do it.
Okay. Now, do you remember the oath, Ganja? Left DC. All right. Well, would you just roll with me? I am a Tribble furry. I am a Tribble true.
I'm a Tribble furry.
I'm a Tribble furry.
I'm a Tribble true.
From the way I roll to the way I coo.
From the way I roll to the way I coo.
So shall it be said, so shall it be done. Welcome, new unto the nation. Andre Carrington is the speculative Tribble. Charlie Brownskin, Charlyn Griffith is Lilith Tribble. And then we have Vincent Williams is the Jack Tribble. Welcome. Welcome. Very to nice. Tribble Nation.
Thank you so much.
Do we get like a coupon to Quiznos or something? Like, how does this work exactly?
I have an invitation. I have a congratulatory invitation.
Okay.
You can visit us at Treehouse Books, 1430 West Susquehanna Avenue.
All right.
And come and pick up a volume of any book we've got on our shelves.
There
and we
go.
Have got a great okay. collection.
All right.
Yes, they do.
Yes.
All right.
And we've got, like I just ordered a bunch of Octavia Butler, too. And if you don't have Lilith's Brood, you can come and get one.
Very nice.
Make it so. And we see if we can get speculative blackness, the future of race and science fiction down there as well.
Yeah. We would love to have you come to a talk.
I would be, not literally, but in book form on your shelves.
Yes.
I don't know if they're like load-bearing. Like all that. So I don't want to say I will literally be on your shelves, but the book will be on your shelves.
You can sit on our couch.
Okay.
And put your book on our shelves.
That sounds appropriate.
Yes.
Nice.
That sounds socially appropriate.
Okay. This has been fun. And honestly, when people are already, they want to get more information, they can go to InvisibleUniverseDoc.com.
That's right. InvisibleUniverseDoc.com.
Dope. That's dope. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this has been fun. This has been a lot of fun. And this has been April, Octavia City, here in Tribble Nation. For Jack Tribble, for Ganja Tribble, for Speculative Tribble, for Lilith Tribble, for the engineered Union Tribble, the Union Tribble, and the Producer Tribble back there. Hey, Producer Tribble. And all my other Tribbles that are taking the night off, this is the Bat Tribble. In parting, we say, hailing frequencies are closed. And now, the mics will drop, and we can get out of here.
Tribble Nation is brought to you by Black Tribbles and WHYY for Newsworks.org. Produced by Kennedy Allen. Executive producers Len Webb and Jeanette Woods. Theme song by Arson, the Voice of Reason, and DJ Why Not. Interstitial music by LMNOP for Good Behavior Music. Check out BlackTribbles.com for all of your favorite Black Tribbles programming, including the flagship show Black Tribbles Prime, Spoiled Tribbles, Throne of Tribbles, and the soon-returning Dead Tribbles Talking. And don't forget to check out Newsworks.org for their Speakeasy blog, many of them brought to you by your Black Tribbles. And now here's something we hope you really like.
Small little break, and then we'll come back in. See, this is easy. Cool.
There you go. Like riding a bike.
Crazy.
Except the wheel's on fire and the bike is on fire, and why is everything on fire and we're in hell?
You're insane, brother.
Wait a minute.
You're straight insane.